Welcome to the Monsters of Fantasy. This was written, produced, recorded, and edited by me, Sean McCarter. Monsters of Fantasy is a production in which I will explore the truly horrific side of the fantasy world known as Dungeons and Dragons. There are content warnings in the show notes below. Episode 26, The Basilisk. So, I listened to the Dryad entry, and while I was at it, I went over a few of the other entries. Changelings, lava mages, ancient red dragons, Lazaran, Merlin, and to top it off, my old captain is a patron to some devil. There's just so many monsters in the world. And here I am, just sitting here reading stories. I've brought it up to Nico, and well, I think it's best I show you.
Hey, Nico. Knock, knock. Well, I've been thinking. You know how I want to see Merlin a few weeks ago? Some scheduling mix-up happened. Got some bloke by the name of John. Anyway, I've been thinking that since that went without a hitch, and you know I've been talking to Daisy. Oh, gods, no. She'd be delighted if you say yes, but no, this is all me. You know my history before here. Pirating, mercenary for the king, slayer of dragons, Nico. I was not just playing an instrument. It was moral support. Look, I don't want to keep fighting with everyone here. You asked to hire a bard, and I'm here now. You can even come along if you want. Yeah, don't have to ask twice. Got yourself a deal.
I can't explain it. Nico was talking in that room, but when I went to re-listen to the conversation, this is what it sounded like. Whenever Nico talked, instead I just heard static. I guess you can gather his side of the conversation, though. He said I'm allowed to do field research. It came as a shock, but he thinks I'm ready. Then he laughed about replacing me if I'm eaten. The last thing he said before the clip ended. He told me that if I decided to take Daisy, to be careful. I don't know what it meant, but before I can go out doing field research, I'll have to go through this pile of what Nico deemed as necessary entries to the monster manual. And he wished for me to record them before I got myself killed. You know, in my 37 years, I haven't ever kicked the bucket, or succumbed to death. My party was no stranger to it either. We had to keep diamonds for resurrections on person at all times, but it seemed that I always had luck on my side. And a cleric. Here's the story of a rescue party, the Phantom Cloaks, led by Crusoe Dawn, encountering the namesakes of Basilisk Isles.
You came here asking for the story, eh, lad? One of your kind came in asking for the story already. Told him to kick rocks. But that was back when I was saving out for a proper bard. Sold the story to that bard of kings. Forgets his name. But I'll sure remember that elf's coin. Newly stamped gold with King Kaiwan's face on it. Seeing as it was long ago, and you're just asking for the bit at the end, once we actually made it on the island, then sure, I'll tell you the story of how I, Crusoe Dawn, legendary knight, escaped Basilisk Isle. There were five of us, called ourselves the Phantom Cloaks. Since then, the Phantom Cloaks have stopped their bravery and heroism, so you may not hear of us anymore. But even so, I don't want it to seem like Crusoe Dawn tried taking all the glory for himself. Believe me, there was no glory to take in it. First was the group's healer, Anduin. A follower of Paylor, but he wasn't like most of the pricks here in the capital. He proved that all that piety doesn't come with the staff up the ass. He's the main reason we made it out of all this. The glue that held us together and fixed all our mistakes. Next was our sorcerer, Freya. a cute and dangerous little halfling. Her magic is unstable, but powerful. Honestly, that kid was the strongest caster I knew at the time. But I'll be damned if she hasn't hurt us more than once. One of our gold rewards went mostly to hiring a druid to regrow her arm after one of these power surges. Wei Shi was our moral compass, and was second to last to join our crew. A monk from the Floating Cities. She was out doing her sabbatical with us, and we happened to take a liking to her. She was as kind as she was deadly. I'd never seen a woman be so lethal only using her fist. Such gentle fist. She taught us how we could use our adventuring for more helpful jobs, like rescuing and saving people from monsters, rather than the ones that required tracking down drug money. Last to join the group was a gnome named Tinkle Rock. Well, that's what he told us to call him. Rather odd little fellow, but Wei Shi and Freya took a liking to him. Freya told the gnome she'd take him on as a student. But Tinkle was older than her, by at least 200 years. I tried prying whatever wisdom might be there within little Tinkle Rock, but I don't know if I ever hit it. Our conversation seemingly ended not with profound insights, but with him running after something shiny. However, in his odd little way, he was useful. He made things, tinkered with things. I have a shield, I shit you not, that when a blade sinks deep enough into it, it'll activate a rune, knocking the person back on their asses. The five of us, the Phantom Cloaks, ended up taking on the request to save the Golden Suns, thanks to Wei Shi. Long story short, King Kaiwen's personal pets, a mercenary group by the name of the Golden Suns, had gone silent on a voyage to Tymir. They were halfway to the Dragonborn city when their wizard last communicated with them, saying they had to make a stop in Basilisk Isles. All communication spells failed, and any attempts at scrying only revealed an empty ship on the coast of the southernmost islands. Our job was to find and recover the bodies of the Golden Suns if they were dead. If they were alive, and we found out they made off with the king's gold, we were to kill them. Either way, we took the king's coin. The job paid up front, 50,000 gold, a ship with a full crew, food and rations for 2 years, and the promise of more on a successful return. The only stipulation was that all of the crew were sworn kingsmen, only meant to get us there and back, and that any artifacts taken from the island could be requisitioned. The last request was said not by the king, but by a middle-aged, crazy-looking man. Can't remember his name, but he had the hair color of fire and had this almost whimsical, jovial presence to him. But when he told us that, he got really serious and made us swear to at least show the items to him upon return. Obviously, we took the job, and the adventures there were as perilous as the 5 hours we spent on the main island. We went through so much that you could write a book on it. Sea monsters, pirates, storms, scurvy, and a wee bit of passion. I'm only telling you all this to really set in your mind just how burnt out we were getting to Basilisk Isles. You know, one thing I found on that journey from other sailors was that the area was not just the small island that made up Basilisk Isles, but rather an entire network of sandbars and reefs to navigate known as Dead Man's Strait. There are very few locals, save monsters, from what we saw, but we never lingered in one place long. At the southern tip of this Dead Man's Strait sat Basilisk Isles, named by many sailors and pirates for their ungodly beast that roamed there. The island, as far as anyone's knowledge, had been void of any humanoids for thousands of years. The only thing that was reminiscent of society was a large stone temple that stood at the center of the small islands. It wasn't the most massive or elaborate-looking temple. I've seen far larger and more polished temples in Athaphos. The stones all looked to be cracked and faded from years of neglect. Roots grew wherever they could find purchase, and trees bearing yellow fruit had grown from one of its sides. From the boat, you could clearly see that twin snakeheads had once been carved on the very top stone, but they too were almost faded. The other thing we noticed when we made dock was a severe lack of, well, anything. Save for the wind moving the small, lush jungle, nothing could be heard. We saw a few fish and crabs scurry along the beach's edge, a few seagulls off in the distance far from the island, but not a sound coming from the jungle. No birds flew overhead, no monkeys swung from tree to tree as we had seen on the other monster-infested islands. Hell, I don't even remember insects buzzing around. The crew did not like that, and neither did we. Like I said, we only spent a total of 5 hours on that island, and if you ask me, that was 4 more than I signed up for, even with all that 50,000 gold. The 5 of us set off to go find the Golden Suns as quickly as possible. Freya tried locating any of them, corpses or not, but that did jack shit. She promised her magic was working, but that something, probably the temple, was blocking her from sensing them. Anduin said a quick prayer to try and find a path that would lead us to them, and sure enough, Pelor shone a glowing beam of light that entered the mouth of the temple. To get to the temple, we would have to travel for about an hour through the jungle at an upward climb. The temple sat so far above it gave us the perfect view of the 2 lion statues that had been placed as sentinels.
"I think,"
Tinkle began in a squeaky voice,
"we have to go in there."
Yet again, pointing out the obvious. Just like you would go on to point out how the island had peculiar stones that littered the beach. I tried telling him that they weren't seashells, but he went collecting pieces and bits of stones as souvenirs, as we made our way into the jungle. A temperate, humid, and luscious jungle. It should have been teeming with life. Insects did return, hiding underneath the low foliage or scurrying away on the ground as we saw them. But none of the fruits seemed to have been eaten or disturbed. The ones still on trees hung ready to be picked or eaten. Some on the way to ripening, but many of the fruits on the ground lay untouched, save a few ants. Wei Shi saw the first sign of another life. Tinkle had gone to take a tinkle away from the group. Worried about the silence, she kept an eye on him and watched him piss on the leg of a dragonborn. At least we thought he was a dragonborn. He could have been one of the lizard folk or even a tiefling. The statue had no head, you see, and half his tail had been broken off. The torso, legs, and one of his arms had been left intact. The arm had a shield strapped to the front of it. Carved into the stone was a device I couldn't recognize. A dragon's head with blood trickling from the throat. Anduin said it was the symbol of an old nation before Vorn had even been founded. However, the device was not of a golden sun, the typical sigil to Pelor. And so we left him. The closer we got to the temple, the more statues would be found in crumbles or cowering in fear. The first one we found with the face was human. Her face and features are frozen in time forever. Whatever it was she saw twisted her young face into a permanent stretch as she screamed. I did recognize her sigil, House Cresthill, enameled on her breastplate. Anduin figured she was a part of the new world explorations that happened during the Child King's short reign. We went on walking deeper, coming across more and more bits of broken pieces of the dead. The jungle didn't clear up any as we climbed either. If anything, it became denser as we rose. There were a few moments where we had to save our less dexterous members of the group. One really bad incident with this one plant in particular, where Anduin's arm had gotten stuck within its mouth. We all laughed until he started shouting that the thing was practically dissolving his arm. When he pulled it out, the skin had been pinkish red all over, and blisters were spewing like he was a leper. More disgusted than really hurt, the group healed him and pressed on. As we neared the looming temple in the distance, I couldn't help but let my mind drift back to that Chesthill girl. If Anduin was right, then we most likely have her and her party sacrificed for our knowledge of these creatures. King Kaiwin, before we left, gave us a brief history of the Isles. That young knight, along with 25 others, perished so that we may know more about the mysterious lands. Rumors had long plagued the island. A tale could be found in every port. But they were just rumors, and the Child King wanted answers. And he got them. The group's wizard allegedly could only send one message before his death. And according to Anduin, it went a little like this.
"Do not look into its eyes. The blue will cause gray. They are all stone. I am stone. Do not look. Do not."
The king would go on to send 3 more expeditions to the Isles before he was assassinated, none of them providing much of use at the time. The current king, Kaiwin, couldn't really tell us how to take down the basilisk. He couldn't say if there were even multiple of them. He said to just watch out for an 8-legged monstrosity the size of a small cottage, and to never look into its eyes. As we came closer to the temple, I never saw an 8-legged monstrosity. We'd been all keeping an eye out so one of us could at least warn the others to blind themselves. The entire sail here, everyone, save Tinkle, trained a little bit daily on trying to navigate while blindfolded. The best, though, was Wei Shi. She was exceptional compared to the rest of us. She generally kept the lead, and was the first to find the graveyard, as Freya dubbed it. At the base of the temple lay hundreds, maybe thousands of stone rocks crushed on the top of each other. Large ones of intact torsos or entire bodies supported the assortment of ears, claws, tails, wings, jaws, and even genitals. We saw every size and shape of statue, all the way down to the smallest of the stones, a fine white powder that surrounded the temple. Climbing the steps were more broken statues, either fleeing or cowering in fear. Near the top, there were 3 others who looked mostly intact, closer to the mouth of the temple. Faintly, a golden light trickled out of the darkness, trailing to Anduin's chest, and gave a faint shimmer before going out. "We're here," he announced unenthusiastically. As if to try and challenge his unhappy attitude, Freya started bouncing up the steps.
"Come on, Andy. Can't be afraid of a few statues."
She bounded up the first 5 steps to a gentleman who looked like he was running away with his head turned back.
"See, they're harmless."
She tapped the statue, and he promptly joined the pile of broken stones below. She grimaced, and to the best of my knowledge, he wore no golden sun.
"It's not them we're worried about."
Wei Shi walked past her and stared up at the 2 lion statues that sat atop of the steps.
"It's whatever made these things. Do you all..."
She paused as if thinking.
"Do you notice how those statues are different than all the others?"
I looked around. "What, the lions? You're right, we hadn't seen any other lions." And Tinkle started to briefly spiral into how lions aren't good swimmers and couldn't have made it from the mainland. When I started to laugh at him, Wei Shi cut me off.
"No, he's right. The lions were definitely placed there. Probably by whoever built this, Crusoe."
She gestured to the stone temple, carved from large chunks of the same stuff of the statues.
"Well, whoever it was probably summoned some 8-legged monster thing in some attempt to worship some snake god, right?"
Everyone looked at Freya, perplexed, even Tinkle.
"What? It's a good guess. That's how all these temple things go, right? Let's just go kick this monster's ass and get paid."
And with that resounding pep talk, we went up the rest of the steps, stuffing the first of the golden sons into our bag of holding. He had been the youngest of the first 5 mercenaries, a human whelp Barry, they called him. He was mostly intact, save for a few fingers that we swear had already been broken off when we found him. The dark, scary threshold into the temple must have been a trick of the shadows. Inside opened up into a massive, walled-in room of color. The sun shone through the open ceiling of the temple, and the floor mosaic danced in the light. The mosaic itself was of snakes, or maybe one giant snake, for I could never find the head. Or if I thought I did, it seemed to move and dart away. The green emerald mosaic seemed to be coiling all around in itself. It almost made the statues that littered the room seem like they were dancing, save for the one spot in the center of it all where the tiles and mosaic had been dug out and thrown to the side of a large hole. There were dozens of statues in here, and so we found 2 more of the golden suns. They had been positioned closest to the hole as if they were peering down. We couldn't identify which of the golden suns exactly they were, for both of them had been only found from the shoulders down. We added them to the bag of holding to join their friend Barry. "Anything?" I asked Wei Shi, who had been studying this one statue in particular.
"Well, whatever monster did this is probably down that hole."
We both glanced over, and Freya was now sitting at the hole, kicking her legs.
"But I don't think this statue is a person."
Anduin and I walked over and inspected the statue. It was of a woman with elvish features. She wore a long gown that seemed to be flowing in the wind. She was barefoot and looked like she had been caught in the middle of walking forward. Both hands were clutched at her heart, and most notable of all, dozens of snakes carved of stone flowed from her scalp. I asked her what she thought it was, if not some weird Yon-Ti who probably started this all. Anduin answered, "Their god? I think this was her temple, or a temple to her. Look, she's poised as if about to walk into that hole. Maybe that's where the altar was?"
"Hey, come on. We don't have all day to talk about conspiracies."
Freya's voice echoed off the walls of the hole as if something were hissing deep below. She gave a twisted smile and glanced at Tinkle. Before Wei Shi could even get the no off of her lips, Freya pushed herself into the dark. Without hesitation, Tinkle leapt in afterwards. The three of us ran over, not knowing what to think of the two, yet again throwing themselves into the mouth of danger. I don't know what I expected to see, but a large hole that burrowed 60 feet into darkness. The sounds of Freya's joyride vanished when it seemed as if the hole swallowed them both.
"It's only about 80 feet down, and it looks like it curves off sharply. I think I can barely see Tinkle down there, or at least his hat."
Wei Shi was already grabbing rope out and was lowering it down. And when it sent down a copper piece he'd channeled the light of Pelor into, and I was fuming at the stupidity of the brat. Sometimes I wonder if it's her magic or her that's wild. I lowered myself down, but quickly noticed something off. In the coin light, Tinkle seemed to be crouching from behind a boulder from the looks of his hat. "Tinkle?" I called out, but he hadn't responded. "Tinkle, buddy, you guys all right down there?" No response. I lowered myself a bit more, but when I noticed that the small boulder had fingers, I let go of the rope. I came crashing down about 5 feet from Tinkle's petrified body. I took a quick glance towards the opening, and for a flicker, I saw the tiny body of a halfling girl frozen in mid-step, surrounded by dozens of faces. And then everything went black. "Shut your eyes now. I'll explain it when you get here." I stood there patiently waiting as Wei Shi lowered Anduin, and then by the sounds of it, jumped off the walls to the bottom of the pit. Once I felt all three of our backs together, "Tinkle's balled up in the corner there. Be careful as we move." They slowly shifted with me as we had practice on the deck. "He's petrified, and so is Freya up ahead." I felt Wei Shi tighten her grip on my wrist. I'm assuming the same to Anduin's because we both stopped.
"It's up ahead."
The words barely left her lips, it seemed.
"Around the corner, something is waiting for us."
We had already planned on such an occasion, even one with Freya throwing herself head first. The plan was to get Anduin to her so he could take care of the petrification. All he needed was his prayer beads and to touch her. Seeing as Anduin was the only one who could cast it, we had a strict plan to abandon him immediately and regroup if he were caught. If it's anyone else, we try to free them. "Just get my hand on her, Crusoe. I can do the rest, even while blinded." I felt Anduin's whisper send a shiver down my neck. Somewhere off in the darkness, I heard breathing. I prayed it was Wei Shi or Anduin, but I knew it was too heavy, too far away to be either of them. "We're here. We just need to rotate clockwise, and she should be right in front of you." I only got a glimpse of the tunnel in the dark for half a heartbeat. I had no idea how far the monster was from us, where it could be lurking from behind the rows of stone corpses.
"Stop!"
I flinched as Wei Shi hissed.
"It's moving towards us."
"Hurry up," I nudged Anduin.
"Where is she?"
he spat back.
I felt way she pull herself apart from us two, leaving us in darkness. She went to tango with the beast. I heard expletives, both from way she and Anduin. She and the monster were clashing with one another. It was roaring, but not like a lion. It sounded like an angry bullfrog hissing and recoiling from what I could hope was a flurry of blows. Anduin was cursing under his breath. It's not working. What do you mean it's not working? It's not working! She's still petrified. She's still a statue. He exhaled. Behind us, we heard Wei Shi grunting as stone collapsed. To the gods, I hoped she's winning over there. Anduin exhaled. Look, I can't fix her. We have to get out of here. His sentence didn't end with a period, but with the shrill scream of Wei Shi. Instinctively, I threw my eyes open. I was facing the back of the monster, a blue-scaled horror. As it pinned Wei Shi against the wall, it looked like someone had mutated an iguana. Red spikes flowed down its back and seemed to stretch on forever, coiling behind the corner. Its upper and lower half were seemingly disjointed as ache-thick limbs walked it around the tunnel. Then everything went black once again as I clenched my eyes shut. Hey! I shouted as I ran at it with my bastard sword. My sword connected with the monster, and a jarring pain went up my arm as it bounced off its hide. The beast roared its frog-like croak in response. Again and again I swung, desperately hoping for my blade to sink into flesh. I felt a hot spray of liquid hitting my face. Thinking it was blood, I grinned, and I hacked away at the same spot. The beast roared in response, and its echoes continued off the walls. Something big and heavy knocked me in my chest, sending me off my feet. But I was back up in no time, listening. Anduin was still cursing to himself, but Wei Shi had gone silent. I called out for her, but got no response. Anduin called for her in the emptiness, his voice echoing off the walls too. I tried listening to where the beast's footsteps were coming from, but there were so many sounds of crunching earth and stone, all of them bouncing off the cave of the underground. I felt a rush of air pass by me and swung my sword out in response, only catching a wall. Two more swings, blindly. Then, I felt that warm tingle down my neck again. My body responded on instinct, throwing itself across the room as breath breathed down my back. I tumbled and rolled through the darkness, getting myself as far from the beast as possible. Somewhere in that inky blackness, Anduin was calling out to me, but I couldn't tell you where. I was too busy, focused on the new set of teeth that had clamped down on my shoulder. I screamed once again, clenching my eyes tight as I could. The teeth were digging into my right shoulder blade, and with my free hand, I tried stabbing at it with my dagger. It felt like trying to stab my dagger into a wall, but eventually, I heard a god-awful screech, and immediately, all the pressure released from my shoulder. I turned around thinking I'd killed the bastard and opened up my eyes. The reason it stopped biting me was that it had a dagger sticking hilt deep in its right eye, a black and bloody pit. It thrashed around, breaking some statues in its frenzy, and almost rolled on top of Wei Shi's unconscious body. I don't know why I kept looking as if the beast didn't have another eye. As soon as it stopped rearing from the shock and pain, it turned back towards me. One eye replaced with my dagger. The other, a glowing pit of blue. For a moment, I felt mesmerized, like I was looking into a sea of ice, the blue of his scales sparkling around his eyes like crystals. I think I snapped out of it rather quickly, but when I tried running, my legs felt like they were lead. I started to panic, thinking my plate had gotten stuck. I began trying to climb out of my armor. The beast lunged at me. I threw my hands up, screaming. It did no good. The beast lunged, biting through the metal armor like it was paper. For a moment, everything went black as the pain washed over me. My eyes clenched shut now in pain more than anything. I felt myself scream once more, the smell of carrion and blood inches from my face. I screamed for my feet to move, but it felt as if I had been cut from the waist down. I tried to move my arms and push the beast away, but they too hung suspended in front of me. That was it. Turned to stone just like dozens of others.
fools we were to think we could handle it. My mind flashed to the others, Tinkle cowering in fear, Wei Shi unconscious or dead. Freya probably lay in crumbles around my feet, and Anduin. Gods, please, I hoped he was able to get out. My eyes were still shut, and I had a drab thought. Back to the Chest Hill girl, face suspended in horror. I decided to look that bastard in the face and spit on him if I could, just before my final moments. Everything felt cold from the neck down, but my face still radiated in warmth. Fuck you! I spat, literally looking the monster in its one good eye, gleaming blue, very blue, blindingly blue. I squinted and looked past the monster and saw Anduin, long sword in hand, radiating brightly with the light of Paylor. His eyes were sockets of flame illuminating his face. His lips were moving fast, but my ears were deaf to everything. The sword, Light Tamer, had pools of radiant light dripping from its edge like molten lava. I don't know if the beast was too preoccupied with killing me, because it didn't turn around as Anduin raised Light Tamer. Or maybe time had just seemed to slow down in those last few moments. I felt the heat leave my cheeks, as the cold completely washed over my skin, leaving a frozen grin for the world to see. Everything went black once more, something I was getting used to. And while everything felt cold and hard, I still felt calm. Somehow I knew that Anduin was out there, and would get us out. Then that feeling, like my body and arms in that cave, became suspended. I don't know how else to describe being petrified, but that feeling, all of those feelings, the fear, the calm, the numbing pain, the cold of the stone, the fading warmth of Paylor, were all suspended in time along with me. Forever. Next thing I know, I woke up on the deck of the ship, gasping for air, as if I had just drowned. Anduin was patting me on the back, giving me the reassuring, "You okay, bud?" I was okay, just shocked and confused. Some of the king's crewmen were gathered around, surely to watch someone be cured of the basilisk curse. Wei Shi stood behind Anduin, bandaged, but otherwise all right. "Where's Tinkle and Freya?" I had just finished drinking the fresh water someone handed me. Anduin hefted up a rucksack made of leather and pointed at it. "In here," he shrugged. Made sense, he was pointing to our bag of holding, an extra-dimensional space where we stored a lot of our crap like clothes and weapons. My head was still throbbing from the sudden awakeness that I felt. "How'd you..." I began, but stopped myself as a sudden sense of pain came rushing into my arms. I started screaming and writhing in pain once more until Anduin and one of the crewmates pulled off my gauntlets to reveal bleeding and stripped flesh. Not even 5 minutes of being awake, I blacked out again. The next few days in the ship's sickbay were interesting. I learned that just as I hoped Anduin did kill the basilisk in time to stop it from outright killing me, he then went on to heal up Wei Shi, who had just been unconscious, and together they both stuffed me, Tinkle, Freya, and one additional gold cloak into the bag of holding. When I asked if they went to find the captain, the last of the expedition, they said they gave up. He very well could have been eaten or a pile of dust for all we knew. I asked if they went deeper to raid for artifacts or secrets, but they decided to head back once they noticed eggshells. When the question came up of whether or not they were basilisk eggs, and then subsequently if what we fought was a baby, we decided to turn the conversation. After saving me and starting the sail back to Voron, Anduin became blessed by dreams from Paylor. Not unheard of being his champion, but he said it was different this time, more personal. In these dreams, Paylor eventually gave him the power to crumble stone. The next day, about 3 weeks from Basilisk Isle, he revived me. It took a toll on Anduin, and we all agreed to let Freya and Tinkle rest a few more weeks before we exhausted all of our resources. However, eventually all of us came out alive and healthy, luckier than most who go to Basilis Isle. I still think to myself sometimes, though, about that Chesthill girl. I wonder if she's still alive like I was, frozen permanently in a stretch of time. Then I think back to that face, suspended in fear. End of story.
You know, I've actually been to the Basilis Isles before.
Or rather, I saw it from the deck of a ship while some of our braver companions went in. After none of the hunting groups returned for 2 nights, the captain ordered we leave them. Unfortunately, I was not as brave as our Mr. Anduin. My job back then was to just keep up the happy tunes. Just like how now, my job is to catalog monstrosities.
I'm curious how Nico has so many notes on the Basilisk, when even our king doesn't have a good understanding of the monster. Part of me wonders if somehow he got his hands on one for an autopsy. Physiology. The Basilisk was a monster summoned to our world, but Nico believes they're quite normal from their homeworld, wherever that may be. We draw that conclusion solely on their ability to breed. This just makes me think of a world infested by giant 8-legged monstrosities that eat giant stones. The Basilisk, from scaled snout to barbed tail, is almost 12 feet long when fully grown. Its skin, already armored and textured similar to the stone it makes, happens to also be covered in red spikes, acting as more natural armor. Second is its slightly acidic mouth, meant to dissolve flesh and stone. These assets, along with its petrifying gaze, something I'll cover in a bit, are the monster's natural defense mechanisms. The reason why such a monster needs them is because of its complete lack of resistance and immunities. Rare thing, honestly, especially from a creature summoned into our world. Nico jotted down here. These are the dumbest, slowest, and ugliest lizards I've to come across. So much so, I've managed to kill one by their own reflection. Attacks and abilities. Before I go into all we know of the beast's petrifying gaze, I would like to note that for the Basilisk to be able to chew through stone, slightly dissolving or not, it must have very powerful jaws. Beware of the Basilisk's bite, almost as much as its sight. Almost. It is recommended one fights the Basilisk completely blinded, for that is the better alternative to a long life spent frozen in time, or a short one in the stomach of a monster. Petrifying gaze. If a creature makes eye contact with the Basilisk, it can infect them with an ancient curse. How the curse works is far from our understanding, but its effects are world-renowned. All of a sudden, the victim will experience a tightening in their muscles and restricted movement as all their skin begins to turn to stone. Petrification is almost completely incurable, save for the most blessed of priests or elite practitioners of magic. So please be careful, and never look into its eyes.
Thank you. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with your friends and family, or leave a rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at monstersof_ for all news and teasers for upcoming episodes. This episode focused on the heroic tale of the Phantom Cloaks, almost getting TPK'd. I always love to run monsters that turn players into stone, and also love to see how many players forget you can turn that gaze right back on them. Join me next week as we continue with the story from Barovia, but not from one of the players who Strahd invited to his domain, but from one of the cursed souls trapped there. Thank you for listening. Until next time.